when it comes to emotion on television, it doesn't say like, don't be open with someone. It's saying don't be open in a manner that is not emotionally intelligent. Might mean yelling or talking rudely or being argumentative.
Welcome to the Emotional Intelligence Podcast, a podcast where we explore the intersection of emotional intelligence and leadership. And whether you're a seasoned executive or just starting out in your leadership journey, we're going to share practical tips, inspiring stories, and expert insights to help you develop your emotional intelligence and achieve your goals. So sit back, relax, and get ready to take your leadership skills to the next level. I'm Ismail.
And I'm Samir. All right. Welcome, everyone. We are very lucky today to have a special guest, James Lawrence. He is the CEO and co-founder of Happy, a coaching platform that improves organizational culture, communication, and manager effectiveness. So James has talked to thousands of business leaders in developing Happy companies. And through these conversations and decades of business experience, which he has, James has seen a consistent issue in today's modern age of remote work: company culture is lacking. And that's what he's looking to solve. So James has set out on a mission to address these issues while making personalized coaching accessible, empowering teams with the skills to get the most out of working together by driving connection, engagement, and productivity. James Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Samir, I never sounded better than when you gave me that introduction.
Well, I'm glad.
He has that way. He introduces me and talks about me, I'm like, what? That's me?
Well, I'm glad I did you justice, James. So James, yeah, we're so happy to have you, man. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been up to.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been a CEO since the age of 19. I dropped out of UCLA, actually, my sophomore year to start my first company. And so it's been, you know, 30 years or 28 years of working with people and leading organizations. And I've seen a lot of exciting, you know, organizational cultures get built. And I've also learned how to do it wrong quite a bit. So, you know, experience has been quite the teacher.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about that, like the career, and step us through that. Like, what were some of your initial initiatives that you took on, and how has it evolved into what you're doing today?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think I've had a lot of the bones of natural leadership, where even in my early 20s, I think when I was 23, my first company, I think we had maybe 25 employees. And I was 23 years old, managing 25 people. And a good handful of those were, you know, more mature, experienced employees. And so it was a little bit of trial by fire. So, I've made every mistake in a book when it comes to leading people. But I think a lot of it's just intent. You know, one of the things that, you know, it's a buzzword now, but, you know, the idea of leadership with empathy, I think, has been really like an early theme in my career. And if there's anything that saved me from a lot of my tragic mistakes as an early leader, it was just like a natural caring for the people that were on our team. So I think as I've run five companies now as CEO or chairman of the board, and I just think kind of doubling down on treating people like humans and learning empathetic leadership's probably been like my biggest, the biggest takeaway I've had, you know, from being a young leader today.
It's such a shame that we actually have to bring that up as something that people should do, treat others like human beings. But because of that, that's why we're here talking to folks like yourself.
Well, Ismail, I mean, it's a good point. I think, you know, this probably goes back to the 60s, like how you would look at traditional leadership in organizations. And I think there's like this mythology of, especially in the United States, of like the American CEO, as it's been a command and control position for so long. And I think we're very blessed, actually, like that it's become a conversation point, because there's a ton of pressure on CEOs today and leaders. I mean, you'd mentioned like part of developing Happy is I was very blessed in 2021 and 22, as I was kind of preparing to launch Happy, I talked to probably somewhere between 500 and 1,000 CEOs and business leaders and heads of HR. And one of the things like I realized is how much pressure there is on a CEO, and not just pressure to like have a high level of organizational culture, but I mean like pressure, financial pressure. You're dealing, you know, with COVID, of course, we had a lot of on-site companies go remote and hybrid, and people really ill-equipped for that. Like, I think I saw a stat the other day that like 85% of managers have never received any training in how to manage a hybrid or remote workforce. It was like a vast number, which is not surprising, right? Because this change happened really fast. And so if you don't have any training in it, and then, you know, you've got a lot of pressure, you know, from a leadership standpoint to perform and to create a profit. And, you know, you can see how these things, you know, multiply to where empathy goes out the window because you don't really know what you're doing.
That's kind of the first thing to go, because it turns into survival at that point, self-survival in a lot of cases, especially for CEOs who are responsible to shareholders, to the board of directors and whatnot. And, you know, I think that that's a very poignant point. Going back though to, I would love to hear more about the beginning of your career. You said, you know, you've made mistakes. You were 23 years old. I can't even imagine being that age, leading a company of 25 employees. Do you, like, when you first were, if you can go back to 23-year-old James Lawrence and you were to talk to that person and say, and like, what were they doing wrong? What did they think leadership was versus what you think leadership is today?
That's a great question. Samir, I think for me, I thought being a leader was having all the answers. And I was very blessed to be surrounded with some great people, some very blunt people. And I had someone pull me aside when I was probably 25 and say, you know, hey, you know, I need to talk to you a little about your leadership style. And it was like hard medicine to take, but the essence of it I got is, you know, you walk in a room and you're the smartest guy in the room. And the problem is that everybody knows it. And you make sure, you know, that you get your way. And when you walk out of the room, you know, some people don't like working with you. And that was a really tough thing to hear at the time, but it was really important because I think I had this perception, especially as a young leader, that leadership was just about, you know, being the one that came in on the white horse and like you were just going to kind of save any problem, right? And so like Marshall Goldsmith in his book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, identified like one of the most tragic issues with a leader is like over improving things. So like I was 25 and everything, I was like a perfectionist. Everything had to be perfect. And so what happens, I would tell the 23 to 25 year old James, is when you over improve things, they become yours and not your team's anymore. And you take like the agency away from the people that actually are doing the work. And if you go from like 85% to 95%, like the idea is better, but it's not like your team's idea anymore. It's like you've taken it over. And so while it might be slightly better, like the ownership that you took away from someone else, it's like that has more damage by taking their agency away than the idea being slightly better. And so I think today what I would typically do is challenge someone, hey, have you thought about this? Or I love five things about this, and there's one thing I'm not quite sure about. If it were me, I might think about this and then let them get it like 5% better, but where they own it and not take it over for them. And I did that a lot.
There's a level of trust that when you take away from them as well. It's like, well, do they not trust me that I'm good enough to do this? And a little bit of broken trust has a huge impact on people, just as ownership does. I mean, I feel like trust and ownership kind of go together. I trust you to own this and take this through all the way to the end. That's interesting. I mean, it's a small nuance, huge impact.
Yeah, no, for sure. And the other thing I would say, I had one other little thing I just came to mind was, so when I first started working with an executive coach, his name was John Delmatoff, and I was early 30s at the time. So it was a few years past that. But one of the things that we talked a lot about, and I realized, you know, I wanted to work on my leadership. And so I had a lot of blind spots as a leader and was lucky enough to find John. But he said to me one day, we were talking about things that, you know, I found difficult in a meeting or where I might overreact. And he had a really interesting comment. He said, you know, sometimes you can't really fix the feeling that you have, but you can control your response to it. And he asked me to figure out what physical trigger could I employ that could change my response. Because I had started realizing at that point that somebody triggered me with something they said. And for me, it was like, maybe it was, I don't want to use the word laziness, but like preparation is really important to me. You show me that you are performing at a high level by your preparation. And so people would come into a meeting and like someone wasn't prepared, right? And maybe I lacked some context and understanding why, but I would just like get this very frustrated feeling like, you didn't prepare for this meeting. And, you know, early in my career, I'd say something like, hey, you didn't prepare for this meeting. Not that that's a bad thing to say either, but it wasn't always said like maybe the best way. And John had a really small piece of advice for me, which was ask for a break or ask to pick up the meeting tomorrow. And I'm like, okay, like that seems like I'm not confronting the idea, but John's point was sometimes you need to build a little physical space, even if you just need to go like, hey, I need to go grab a water. And then I just walk around the block, but it would just like take off the emotional responsiveness. And so for me, I became known in my company. I'd be right in the middle of a meeting and I'd be like, hey guys, I just need to take a quick potty break or something. And like, I just did 5 minutes and everybody realized at some point that I didn't have to go to the bathroom, but I was just resetting. Yeah. And they're like, oh man, like James is really frustrated, right? But I come back in and I'd be like, all right, guys, let's keep working on this. But like, it was just for me, fixing the response was more like trying to change my behavior to it.
I like that. I remember one time somebody had advised me before you send an angry email, take a lap around the office and then come back and read it again. And if you still want to send it, then send it. But you know, you got to give yourself at least that one lap to see if you get that cooling off period. But
I know for just on that example, numerous times where I've written something and come back and haven't sent it, but I feel so much better. And it was just because I got it out of my system. Right. Anyone could have read it or anyone could have other than the person it was directed to, which would have done damage. And it makes a huge difference. And it's interesting. I always did like the 24 hours, Samir, but I think all you need is the lap.
Yeah. Just need the lap. In our industry, 24 hours, that's like, that's like 2 months, man. If you don't reply within 20 minutes, you're pretty much just blacklisted.
You know what's funny though on that end is I think one of the things young managers and young leaders mistake is they mistake responsiveness for a lack of candor. Like I've had this exact conversation with some young leaders and they'll say like, well, I read, like one of my favorite books is No Rules, Rules by Reed Hastings, who's the founder of Netflix. And like candor is a really big part of like Netflix's, culture. And I've had people say, well, you know, so you're saying I shouldn't tell the truth or I shouldn't be transparent or I shouldn't be candid. And I think that's like this really kind of like young look at that. I don't mean young in age, but just kind of like an unevolved look, which is like, you can still be really candid, but do so in a responsive way rather than a reactive way. We're not really talking when it comes to emotional intelligence. It doesn't say like, don't be open with someone. It's saying don't be open in a manner that is not emotionally intelligent. Might mean yelling or talking rudely or being argumentative. You know, there's lots of ways to be candid and direct with someone and do it like with empathy. Like you can do those things. They're not mutually exclusive.
So when you said like, you said can't like have candor in your responsiveness and reaction, what is the distinction there? Do you see with those two things?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if you take a step back and look at candor and transparency, I think on its face just mean that you're willing to be open with someone and you're willing to take some emotional risk with sharing something that maybe somebody doesn't want to hear, but it doesn't mean that you have to do it in a reactive way. And I would say some of my most effective conversations have come in moments where, you know, I've had a lot of time to think about it. It doesn't mean that the conversation is going to be easy.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. We hope you're enjoying the episode so far. If you want to stay updated on all the latest content and behind the scenes action, be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and several other places by using the link in the show notes. And if it's not too much trouble, we'd love for you to leave a review and share this episode with some of your friends. Your support means everything to us, and we can't wait to connect with you online. Now, let's get back to the show.
One of the questions that I had was, when you had these conversations with HR leaders, executives, senior executives, what were some of the things that they found challenging about developing a culture or creating engagement within their teams?
That's a tough question. I think probably, you know, we'll just start with kind of the changes in the world of work. You know, I think this idea that you want to build a great organizational culture, I mean, that's something great to put up on the wall. But then when it hits the real world and like half of your team used to bond over Taco Tuesdays or, you know, the, you know, having a coffee at 9 a.m. and then you've got a team that maybe is 40 or 50% hybrid and people are not together anymore, I think it becomes much more difficult to be intentional with those kind of organic moments that bond a team. I think some of the challenge is just blocking and tackling of like, does your team get together? How do they interact with each other? When do they interact with each other? In fact, one of the companies right now that's kind of in our onboarding pipeline with Happy is a 400 person team that, you know, the company was created and I think they launched in 2020 and they've never had the entire company all together. It's a remote team. You know, luckily they've built a lot of good collaboration opportunities from a remote standpoint, but this is a group that's never been in the same place together. So that's hard, right? And so 5 years ago, that would have been like, hey, you know, we're having the company all hands meeting, or we're having, you know, a park day this summer, or we're going to have a Christmas party. Well, like they don't even have a Christmas party in one place or a holiday party. So that's just harder because there's so many natural like connective tissue that happens that, you know, doesn't happen when you're fully remote. So it's funny though, to answer your question, I started from 2021 to 2022 when I started talking to all these CEOs and leaders. One of the things that I started realizing is an all remote team is actually easier in many ways than a like hybrid or combo team. Because if you think about it, the CEOs that run remote teams, like everybody's remote. So everybody kind of like coalesces around like, oh, okay, what are we going to do? Like, oh, Tuesday night, we do like drink a beer with Ishmael night. And like everybody gets together and watches Friends and like, and 50 people get together and do that remotely. And so like, it becomes an all remote culture. But what happens when you're like 40% of your team's remote, you have three offices, and then even those people that are on site are like hybrid and some are like, some prefer to come in, and then other departments are like only in the office. Now you have like almost three mini cultures that have built. You have like your all remote people, your people that are like bonding on site, and then your people that are like kind of in between. What I've been told is that is the hardest mix. And I believe that from all of the CEOs and heads of HR that I've talked to. We call it jambalaya.
Prior to COVID, there were companies that were all remote. There have been. Like one that comes to mind is Automattic. I think it's the founder of WordPress. And their company, I believe, is completely remote, or majority is remote. But right from the beginning, they have thought about that and they've built their culture around remote. And so it's probably pretty simple for them when there's all this news or stress around remote. This company, or you know, the companies that are remote, are probably like, why is this such an issue? And I think it's because they've already spent the time and put in the systems and the processes to make sure that remote culture is thought of right from the beginning. Then you have these new companies, folks that you're talking to, for example, who are like, whoa, this is something. And I mean, it doesn't have to be a terrible thing. It doesn't have to be a difficult thing. It will take some time if you're able to come up with processes and different activities like you were describing that work. But you're talking about three potential subcultures, which might mean you have to. I mean, you tell me, if there are three subcultures, are they actually maintaining the three subcultures?
Yeah, I mean, this comes down to a deeper question, Ishmael, which I love that you're queuing this up, because I think this comes down to this idea of like, is it worth is it worth it for our organization to invest in our organizational culture? And that's something like I ask a lot, because obviously like with our technology, we get into this very early question of like, well, what's it cost? How much time does it take to implement? Like, how does it work? So like it comes to the forefront. So the question is like, if you're going to have this kind of like in between workforce, like on-site, hybrid, remote, like how intentional do you want to be? Are you able to be about like investing in your organizational culture? And then like, how much do you really believe that that's like a competitive advantage? Now, I can tell you that I believe that people are a massive competitive advantage. Like when you have, and I think the data shows that. I mean, I know we were talking about this a little bit before the call about Gallup's recent survey they've just released on 2024 from all their survey data from last year, which was a survey of over 100,000 businesses or operating units. You know, healthy organizational cultures just perform better, sustainably better, more profit, more productivity, lower, you know, turnover, better retention. But are you really going to invest in it, right? It's kind of like, you know, medicine versus like vitamins. Are you going to like go to the gym? Are you going to like take the vitamins? Or like, you know, are you going to be take the medicine later, you know, when your organizational culture is like in trouble?
I mean, when the minute you use that analogy of vitamins, I'm like thinking to myself, man, I got to take my vitamin D. Everyone needs vitamin D. I'm like, I'm too.
Especially Chicagoans.
Yes. In the winter. Yeah. And like there's this pile of vitamins I should take. Sometimes I take them. Sometimes I don't. I take them when I'm not feeling good. And when I'm starting to feel good, I don't take them. And so if you have a culture, if you have a company, and I'm just kind of extrapolating, but if you have a company that seems to be doing well, your investment may drop in that culture. And it's one of these things that probably lags behind that investment. And so is this I'm assuming this is a choice that organizations need to make, which means they need to think about whether they want to do it in the first place.
Well, I'll give you an example. So say two or three different conversations that I've had in the last week. One of the things that we've discussed is we get back the following response. We might have engaged in one or two conversations about Happy, and we've usually at that point discussed someone's organizational culture, their retention, their objectives with their managers. Like we've gotten far enough down to like kind of isolate like what their current state is and what their ideal state is. But you might hear a comment like this. You know, the management team doesn't know if they have the bandwidth to invest in, developing EQ we don't know if we have the time to do it. And that doesn't really have anything to do with Happy as a technology, but it's more just like a general statement. And I think that's a really tough question. Like, I'm not trying to make fun of that as a response, because you wake up in the morning and like your email is going crazy and you've got, you know, 17 projects you're working on and you've got some revenue targets and maybe you missed, you know, one of your other KPIs. And the question becomes like, am I going to sit down tomorrow and work on my organizational culture when my email is like a dumpster fire? That's the reality of what really happens. And then so like what I like to do is say, let's identify, this is kind of like exercise. And like if you're an athlete, it's like, okay, well, like I have to jump higher because I'm a basketball player. But if you're in sales, you might think, well, I have to sell more. It might be not intuitive to go, I need to learn EQ. You might go, well, how does that help me sell more? And I would say, well, your support team is probably pretty important. So you probably have a sales operations manager. You probably have a sales assistant, probably have a VP or, you know, chief of business development. How would better relationships with your entire support staff enhance your ability to sell? But it isn't like an immediate direct line. And so I think when your leadership team, how your leadership team approaches this is really critical. If your leadership team understands the connection between organizational culture and happy employees and positive work relationships, I think it's a lot easier to see through the forest. And you go, this is not something up for debate. Like, we are going to have a top level organizational culture. We're going to invest resources in it. We're going to take the vitamins. And that's just going to be part of our organizational DNA. And there's a phenomenal stat that Gallup released last month, which said that the average organization has about 20 to 22% of the workforce is engaged. This is the average, not, by the way, the lowest 25. This is like the average is engaged. And then there's like a soft middle that's like neither engaged nor disengaged. And then there's obviously the disengaged people. But the highest 25% of organizations have between 60 and 80% engagement. So this is the delta between average and top 25%. And it is like the difference between a quarter of your employees being engaged and like 75% of your employees. But if you do that, your retention and your profit and your productivity are all like 25% better. So you would think, like, looking at the data, it's just really a good, compelling business decision to invest in your people.
And I think that it is low hanging fruit, but people don't treat it that way. Like, that's a, it's a quick win for companies to go in and invest in EQ, invest in their people, drive engagement that way. But then they look at other ways of cutting costs, like that come at the, you know, people's jobs, maybe you cut travel, maybe you cut the Christmas party. And I think that there's like this, you know, there needs to be an ideological shift there where companies are seeing the benefit of investing in their people. A question that I had for you, James, is as a company, if I'm an executive leader at a company, I'm typically dealing with my direct reports. I'm dealing with maybe my fellow executive team. How am I best able to take stock of whether my team is engaged? How do I know, sitting from in my office in a, let's take a example of a company that is half hybrid, half remote, that three-headed monster that you described earlier, how do I take stock of understanding whether my team is in that bottom 22% of engagement? Because from where I'm sitting, everyone's happy. Everyone comes to me and like, hey, boss, how you doing? You're looking good, you know, but how do I know that's the reality under when I kind of lift the rug?
Yeah. So I mean, that's a great question. I'm going to answer that in two ways. I think you have to take like a micro and macro look at that question, because you can survey a lot of people and get like bogus results, right? That's kind of what you're talking about, is like, regardless of how you're asking them, if is it like I'm asking you on a one-on-one way, I'm asking you via like a survey, I've done an engagement survey, or I'm asking my managers what they're hearing. And, you know, this is where the word, like, I think psychological safety is kind of like a fun buzzword to use, but like, look, what that really means is like, is the organization open to having these kind of conversations? And is it genuinely interested in listening? And it doesn't mean there's not going to be like tough conversations. I mean, I think the healthiest cultures sometimes still have lots of tough conversations, and they also have to make really tough decisions. Like, that's not mutually exclusive. But I think on a like a macro standpoint, have we created an environment where it's safe to talk about this kind of stuff? Like, can you put your hand up and go like, hey, I'm not that happy, or like, I've got a frustration? And if you're not an environment that can do that, it doesn't really matter what your survey results are, because it's just going to be weaponized. And when I say weaponized, I mean, like, for you to put your hand up and go, hey, I think we're really goofing this up. And then you kind of like, that's a big demerit, like, to your career, like your boss doesn't like it. And there's like this famous line that I like to use when I'm talking to CEOs about this, which is like, if your boss ever says the following words to you, don't ever say that in a meeting in front of me, you made me look bad. I don't care what you put on the wall. I don't care what your values are. I don't care what your organizational culture says. Your boss has just told you, I don't want an open, transparent environment that's vulnerable. I mean, that's what's really just happened there. And then you can't expect someone, when that's being said, you can't expect them to fill a survey out and go like, yeah, I'm not really like happy. In fact, I don't really like A, B, and C. They just go like, yeah, I'm good. And then you're like, you could have a crappy culture, but everybody's like reporting they're okay. And that's all bad.
What I'm gathering, you're saying it's a top-down kind of thing, right? Like, where the it needs to be, that openness needs to be created from the senior executive level, where they actually are willing and ready and participating in activities that are bringing out the truth.
Yeah, I would say it. I would say that's true, but maybe I would phrase this slightly differently. I would say, yes, the leadership needs to be committed for sure. But when we start talking about organizational design, and one of the things that like we've engineered into Happy is this idea that when you're at scale trying to improve organizational culture, you have to look at something very simple. And it's why training and seminars aren't always that effective, like episodic training and seminars, is because even the best organizations have somewhere between like 8 and 10% churn or retention every year. So even like your best organization in a 100-person team, you've got 10 new team members and you've got 10 team members that have like rotated out. It could be retirement. It could be, you know, finding another opportunity. It could be they're out of the workforce. Could be expansion. There's all kinds of different reasons. So the 10 new people are bringing in their own cultural norms from their last company, where maybe openness and empathy and transparency weren't things they're used to. So you have to have this like constant vigilance to like your organizational DNA. And so, yes, it's really there's really three parts to this. The leadership team is one of them, which is they are the tip of the spear when it comes to setting expectations. But the second thing is hiring, right? So now I'm going to hire people and I'm bringing 10 new people in the organization. So I would say HR and your talent side and your managers, what happens when you're hiring and you find this phenomenal salesperson, but they aren't really like a cultural or like a good fit for your values, or like you go, oh, well, Marcy will deliver results, but yeah, she can really like blow up, you know, the meeting sometime, where she, you know, she's a hothead, but like she's a performer, but you hire her anyways. Like, what are you bringing into the organization? And then I think the last part is like this commitment to continuous like retraining when it comes to like EQ, because it doesn't matter what the leadership team believes in from an organizational DNA standpoint. When you get those 10 or 15% new people in the workforce, like how are you training them and showing them like how you do things? It's probably unfair to expect them to just feel safe being super open in a new organization, unless they're like, that's part of the process of bringing in a new person. You got to like show them how things are done.
You partially answered this question just in your previous statement, but there's companies that are small, companies that are big. We know that the education, the concepts of, we'll just use EQ as an example, they're the same whether you teach it to someone who's small, a small company or a large company. So there's, and you mentioned the word scaling, there is a scaling component to this that is an open question, I believe, because how do you scale training or happiness or emotional intelligence to a 100,000 person company? Because I think it would be more difficult than trying to do it to a 100-person company. And I know this might be a long answer. If you want to give your just general opinion and thoughts, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate you queuing that up, because that's literally why we invented Happy's technology. I'll give you like my own experience very briefly. And then if you might have some questions, then we can kind of like dive into explaining why we kind of developed Happy. But, you know, I'd mentioned the executive coach that I found, and I got like that aha moment working with him. And it was like, you know, the proverbial like goat on the mountaintop moment, right? Like I was working with this executive coach, and like he just really helped open up really a lot of self-awareness and like just really unlocked me. And so I felt like I was that goat climbing up the top of the mountain, and I got up to the summit and I looked around in like this beautiful valley. And I'm like, you know, this was I got incredible value from this executive coach. Now, I don't know, I think John's retired now, so he probably doesn't mind me sharing this, but like the cost of that was $300 an hour, right? You know, so it was like, it was not inexpensive to get the aha moment, but like John was extremely good at what he did. And then I thought, man, this was so great that I wanted my entire leadership team to kind of get that experience. And so, you know, we had 7 people on our leadership team, and I'm like, okay, well, this was expensive, but I got like great results. So like, I want to take the same type of one-on-one coaching I got And it made me a better leader. It made me a better manager. Probably, frankly, made me better my relation with my wife. So I'm like, this is great. So we got coaching for all seven members of the leadership team. And John couldn't do all seven. So we brought in another coach. I think his name was Mike at the time. And the results went from like an A to like a B. Now, still really valuable. But you go, why was it a B? Well, John and I kind of found each other and I really resonated with John. Well, like our leadership team, three or four people were coaching with John. Like one person loved John, one or two people liked John. And then I think one of the people that were coaching him just didn't like click with him. And it was still good, but it just like he wasn't their spirit animal. And the second thing was, you know, we had the other coach came in and the other three people liked working with him. But then we'd get in like a team meeting and somebody would say like, well, John says that this is how we should sort through this. And someone would be like, well, I have a totally different take. Like Mark doesn't do it that way. And so even just in our own little Petri dish, like we were kind of getting like, well, we have two different like ways we're being coached to do this or like even look at the whole problem. And then a couple of times someone's like, well, Mark told me this about this is how I should handle it with you. And so like we almost had like inner coach conflict, like just different ways of doing things. And it was okay. Long story short, we were still getting a B or B plus. But then we asked the question, how do we distill this to the entire organization at scale? We had 100 employees at the time. And we're like, how do we take this magic sauce that we got from these human coaches and these executive coaches? And how do we, and we ran what I would call is the traditional playbook of how companies do this kind of thing, which is we kicked off of workshops. So we had workshops, we had seminars, we had EQ training. You know, we all got together and we were implementing DISC at the time. So we all wore different colored shirts and like we had the red shirts and the blue shirts and like everybody got the 40-page PDFs. And it was all great for like 3 weeks. And then like people forgot their styles. And like 3 months later, nobody could remember like what their DISC assessment was. And like they lost the t-shirt or like their red faded to like white and they were like a different color now. But it just, it's like the effectiveness slid. And then we're like, oh, we need more workshops. And like, we hired five more people. And I truly gained an appreciation for how difficult this is at scale. And now I talk to CEOs that have 5,000 people. And then like the 100 people is like, you know, a drop in the bucket compared to like the scale of 5,000. And so long story short, it's really hard. What you described is really hard to do that at scale.
So what is Happy doing to help solve that problem?
Let's talk about Happy. Now I want to talk about Happy.
Okay. So this starts with, I know I like telling stories. I'm trying not to go over length, but so a friend of mine who had developed a couple of the ideas behind Happy is a director in a large tech company. And, you know, I'm like, man, the biggest tech companies in the world have to have like gnarly ways to solve this problem. But no, they just have the same tools that everybody else did, which is like Google Slides and stuff like that. So like everybody in the company made these little baseball cards that had their DISC assessment. It had like do's and don'ts with working with me. It had a little like personal information, like, you know, how long you've been at the company and just, you know, just some basic stuff. And everybody, this was pre-COVID, so they put them outside their cubicles. So you'd go over to like John's desk or Amanda's desk and she'd have a little like, you know, baseball card about how to work with her. And so I, again, this was like 5 years ago or a little bit before that. And so I made them for our company and they had our pictures and it was really cute. And so someone as a practical joke, like took mine and took the, like my picture and like changed it to like an avatar of like a ninja, like an 8-bit video game ninja or something. So it didn't have my picture. It had like, it looked like a video game, but it was still the rest of me. And like a CEO was walking in my door and he like stopped and he looked at this and he came in the office and he's like, that is really cool. That was on your desk. He goes, what like software program built that? And I'm like, that was like Photoshop or something. Like someone did that as a joke. And he didn't like fully believe me. And we talked a little bit about it. And then on the way out, he looked at me and he's like, I know you're up to something. Like, tell me what program built that. And I'm like, okay. And like, it just like went right over my head. And then I woke up at 4 a.m. and I'm like, holy, you know what? Like, why can't there be a technology solution to this? Like, why do I have to get 40-page PDFs on how to work with someone when like I'm about to walk into a meeting and I'm about to walk in a meeting with Samir, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to remember, like, give me three tips on how I should like work with Samir, or I'm getting a review and like, I got to go dig through my email to find like page 37 of like my work assessment that I took 3 years ago. So that's where Happy came from. I mean, and I can tell you about Happy, but like, I don't know if that's a funny story or not, but like,
yeah, that's a cool story. Yeah, definitely. And so it's like pretty much like a software tool, and it's giving you live feedback on people's kind of preferences and communication styles and their demeanors, and sort of like in a Facebook style database is what I'm.
Yeah. Really easy. So really easy explanation. So we use behavioral science and AI. So we can at scale in 10 minutes, understand how everybody in a organization tends to behave at work. So we can, takes about 10 minutes to take the Happy assessment, and it's inspired or modeled on DISC. We can talk a little bit more later. You guys might be interested in some of the things we do differently than like a standard DISC assessment, but it's modeled on like 80 years of EQ science. But once we know what everybody's work styles are, we can actually build a user manual to how to work better with everybody in the organization at scale. And so a very brief explanation of our technology. So if you guys have taken like a DISC assessment or Myers-Briggs or like an Enneagram, I'm sure you have because you're like the EQ experts.
So, yes, that's true.
So Ishmael, where is like your, like, let's do a quick test. Like, where is your DISC or your Myers-Briggs? Like, if, like, how quickly can you find it?
I know my Myers-Briggs, ENFP.
Okay, so you're an ENFP. So if we had let's say we had your 30-page PDF and you gave it to Samir and I, it would be like a generic work style assessment, right? Samir and I would look at it and we'd both read the same thing. Well, Happy's technology works differently. If Samir and I looked your profile up in Happy and looked up your work style, because Happy understands Samir and I's work style, what actually would happen is it would provide us with a different insights on you. In other words, because he and I are different, when we looked up your profile, it would give us like different advice. It profiles, it contextualizes and personalizes all of the advice and insights and coaching in the platform to your work style, which makes it totally different than every product that's out there, different than any other assessment. And so it's just providing personalized context. And so it doesn't just deliver it in app though. So like we deliver in the flow of work. So for example, you get a daily coaching tip via email that's personalized and contextualized for you on somebody you work with. You can get tips in Slack, Microsoft Teams, connects with Google Calendar and Chrome. And so it's using the tools that you already use to basically provide you this kind of coaching insights. But the last thing I'll say is we have this little saying about like CEOs will ask a question like, what's your roadmap look like? Like, what are you developing? They want to understand because like if they're going to try Happy, and usually most of our CEOs or VPs of HR that are looking at this are already like pretty innovative. So we talk about like coaching on the right person at the right time with the right advice. So it's like three things you have to do well. So the picture I want to paint for you is like, you've got a Zoom call with Samir tomorrow at 11. And at 9, it sends you a Teams message and says, hey, you've got a meeting with Samir in 2 hours. Here's three things you should do in your meeting. Here's something you shouldn't do. Do you want any more guidance? And you can go, sure. And it'll go, okay, here's a couple more communication tips. Hey, do you want to learn a little bit about Samir? And you can like look up Samir's profile and maybe you find out that like he loves the Kansas City Chiefs. So it kind of gives you like context, humanization, and advice. But then an hour or two after your meeting, it says, hey, Ishmael, how was your meeting with Samir? Totally confidential. My meeting was great. It was okay. Meeting wasn't so good. Why wasn't your meeting that great? And it might say, it'll give you a couple options. You might say, oh, there was a lot of conflict in the meeting. And so Happy now has a piece of information. Doesn't go to HR, doesn't go to Samir, but it knows that the two of you had a conflict and that Samir ran a meeting that maybe had a little bit of conflict in it. Now, totally secure. Nobody's getting this information except the platform, which is anonymized. But it'll start coaching Samir when it delivers coaching over the next couple of weeks. It'll start giving him coaching on how to like maybe run a better meeting or a more effective meeting. It also knows what your work style is and what Samir's work style is. So it also notes that there was some conflict, and it looks for a history, like with Samir, like maybe he consistently has a conflict with a particular style of person. So what it would do then is it would give Samir some coaching and guidance over time on how to like more effectively work with that style. But it does this all in the background. And so you ask a question of like, how does this work at scale? Well, that's what Happy does at scale. So we believe in human coaching. So I don't want to give any impression. We think human coaching, one-on-one coaching is the best form of coaching that one can have. It's contextualized, it's relevant, it's personalized, it's motivational. But no organization is going to hire 50 or 100 or 300 human coaches. And so for what you'd spend on one or two human coaches, leave those coaches maybe with your managers or for acute situations. And then Happy is designed to work with 400 people in the organization. So we can provide that insights and nudges and coaching for like a very, very large group in a very efficient way.
That's so great, James. We really appreciate the explanation of Happy and all of your insights today. How do people get in touch with you if they want to learn more about James Lawrence, the person, James Lawrence, the CEO of Happy? How do people get in touch with you?
Yeah, I mean, happycompanies.com is our website. So you can just visit us there and you can find me on LinkedIn. And, you know, I'm really passionate about this work. You know, to me, this is way beyond just Happy. You know, while we do believe in our technology, there's lots of smart people that are working on this. You'd actually brought something up that I thought was really beautiful, which is like this idea that like, hey, we're having these conversations, which is something I think that you guys, I think it's really absolutely awesome that you guys surface this. Like this is, you wake up, you know, and talk about this and you're investing in this on your podcast. But that's really, to me, like the more people that can talk about the value of emotion intelligence, the value of developing these soft skills. Like at the end of the day, we want people to walk into work and love what they do. And that's having like the tools to interact with each other in like a healthy, productive way. And that underpins everything. And so, you know, I really want to take my hat off to you guys. You know, I watched a bunch of your podcasts getting ready for this. And like, you guys ask tough questions. You know, you guys are invested in something that like is a little off the beaten path, but like it takes a lot of courage to do what you do, which is to talk about this all day long.
Yeah. Thank you, James. We appreciate that, man. And we're definitely going to stay in touch with you. Hopefully we can have you back on the podcast someday, and we will link to all of your, you know, your social medias, happycompanies.com, in our show notes. So if folks want to check you guys out, thank you so much for being so giving with your time this afternoon. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of the Emotional Intelligence Podcast. We hope you found it informative and enjoyable. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And if you have a moment, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave a review on your favorite platform. Your feedback helps us improve and reach more people. If you're interested in learning more about the topics we discussed today, be sure to check out the show notes for links and resources. You can find them by visiting our website. And if you have any questions or feedback, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us by email at info@emotionalintelligence.com or connect with us on social media by using the links in the show notes.